Witajcie, z tej strony Michał Oleszczyk. Witam w kolejnym odcinku podcastu Spoiler Master, podcastu do słuchania po seansie. Zapraszam Was do wysłuchania odcinka, jeżeli widzieliście film, o którym mówię, ewentualnie jeżeli nie boicie się spoilerów, ale przede wszystkim witam Was oficjalnie w drugim sezonie mojego podcastu. Zaczynam w tym roku numerować odcinki od początku. Wszystkie poprzednie, niemal 30 odcinków jest nadal do wysłuchania. Zapraszam serdecznie. Natomiast postanowiłem, że pierwszy odcinek tegoroczny roku 2020 będzie odcinkiem specjalnym. Odcinkiem specjalnym ze specjalnym gościem. Gościem, którego już znacie, jeżeli słuchaliście poprzednich odcinków Spoiler Mastera. Mianowicie gościem będzie profesor Patrick Vaughan, profesor Uniwersytetu Jagiellońskiego, amerykanista i historyk Stanów Zjednoczonych, u którego ja sam miałem przyjemność o tej historii słuchać jeszcze jako doktorant Instytutu Amerykanistyki i Studiów Polonijnych Uniwersytetu Jagiellońskiego, a pretekstem i powodem do rozmowy jest film, który omawiałem w ostatnim odcinku, to znaczy Irlandczyk Martina Scorsese. Film, który, jak zasygnalizowałem, ma dosyć skomplikowane i głębokie tło historyczne, mianowicie postać Jimmy'ego Hoffy i związki zawodowe w Stanach Zjednoczonych, także kwestie powiązań tych związków zawodowych z mafią. I tak jak w ostatnim odcinku, do którego zapraszam, jeżeli go nie słuchaliście, opowiadam o tych kontekstach dosyć krótko, tak w tym pierwszym specjalnym odcinku roku 2020 postanowiłem zapytać znawcę, specjalistę, historyka Patryka Vaughana o niuanse właśnie tych spraw związkowo-mafijnych, a także o postać samego Jimmy'ego Hoffy. A zatem w tym pierwszym noworocznym Spoilermasterze daję Wam zaproszenie do tego, żeby pogłębić troszkę wiedzę o historii Stanów Zjednoczonych. Sam też ją pogłębiłem w trakcie tej rozmowy i dowiedzieć się trochę więcej o tym fascynującym historycznym tle, jakim w Irlandczyku jest Hoffa i jego działalność. A zatem zapraszam naszego gościa. My guest today is Professor Patrick Vaughan of Jagiellonian University, and we already had a wonderful talk on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood a couple of months ago. And today I wanted to talk to you about The Irishman, but really about the context of the film, and especially about this very fascinating character of Jimmy Hoffa. The film ends with a nurse in this sort of nursing home telling Frank Sheeran, played by Robert De Niro, that she doesn't know who Hoffa is. And this is, he's sort of amused by that. He says, you know, time flies, like people forget. But there was a time in American history when everybody knew who Hoffa was. And when I was talking to my friends, when I was reading some responses online to The Irishman, I realized that in Poland, Hoffa is completely unknown. So let's lay some groundwork. Like who was Jimmy Hoffa and why was he so crucial to history of labor in America and of crime in America?
Well, Jimmy Hoffa is a really an American story. It's a guy that came from almost nowhere to become a powerful union leader, and especially in the 1950s and early 1960s. When labor union leaders, everybody knew who they were. You knew who the leaders of these giant industrial unions were because they were politically very important. And the unions had a lot of electoral strength, and they obviously were popular media figures like Jimmy Hoffa. He was charismatic. He had sort of this underdog image of fighting for the working man. And even if he was corrupt, people said, well, he's taking on the man. He's taking on Wall Street, and we support him. So Jimmy Hoffa was probably the most famous of these labor leaders at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, explain a little bit, because I think that this is something also that we are kind of missing out on in Poland. The history of labor in America, the history of unions in America, we often don't realize here just how violent the conflict between the workers and the, let's say, the owners of the of factories, between the capital, could be, and especially in the 30s, it seems like it was like a genuine war going on.
Well, if you look at the history of early industrial capitalism, especially in the late 19th century, there were no such thing as labor unions. You could see that any attempt to organize one would be met with violence by the companies. They would just hire goons and just hit you over the head with an axe handle, you know, to discourage any kind of organization. But you can see if the early industrial capitalists, whether it's the coal mines or the steel industry in and around Pittsburgh or the car industry, probably Henry Ford is kind of an exception to this, but he paid a living wage, but he wasn't really friendly to unions. Unions were seen as a threat, or almost in terms of like the film Meituan, you could see it was laced with communist, kind of the Red Scare era. So Jimmy Hoffa was an early guy that fought back against this. He says if the companies don't play fair, we don't have to play fair either. And that explains probably the idea that you have to strengthen yourself by organizing. Otherwise, they're going to do it divide and rule, and you're not going to make any wages. You're not going to make a living wage, and they're just hire replacement workers. We need a strong union. And that was really the story of the 30s.
Mm-hmm. Well, but in the movie The Irishman, we basically see Hoffa mostly in late 50s and 60s and onwards. But it's important to remember that by then he was already like in his 50s, right? I mean, he has a long history of engagement with like political fight. I mean, even as early 30s, right? It's a long story of defiance, courage, and hard knuckles.
Jimmy Hoffa's father was a coal miner. And if you know anything about the history of the coal mines, they would work those guys to death and just replace them when they died with black lung or whatever. So he learned, I think, the hard way that if you're going to be a worker in that country, you better learn to fight and to organize. And his early experience, he moved from southern Indiana to Detroit, which at the time was one of the biggest industrial cities in the country. And he learned to organize at a grocery store, Kroger's. It's just still there. That's still a company. If you go in Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia, those grocery stores still exist. And he learned this idea that you've got to fight back. And if you're a teamster, which is just a term that means delivery, like the trucks and driving things to and from places, you have a lot of power. And that's why the teamsters was especially powerful in the United States, is because if you don't get goods to market, they rot. And a strike is especially effective in that particular industry.
Mm-hmm. Well, so now let's try to tie this up, to tie all of this to the issue of mafia in the United States, but very specifically to the point when the general public in the States became first aware that mafia is there and that it's very highly powerful in terms of like political influence. When was that, and how Jimmy Hoffa was sort of involved with that? When Americans first realized that, hey, there's like this state within a state being run.
Well, there were always gangster films even in the 30s. You could see it. And sometimes they were bad guys. Sometimes they were kind of sympathetic good guys, like Robin Hood type of characters. But I think the first time you really started to see this in film, probably on the waterfront with Marlon Brando, how you see this, how the mob controls this longshoremen's union and it's corrupt. And a couple of years after that, of course, were the McClellan Senate hearings, where Jimmy Hoffa had to defend himself against a young up-and-coming attorney named Robert Kennedy. And Kennedy, wanting to make a name for himself politically, his brother was a senator from Massachusetts with ties to Joe McCarthy, incidentally. So I think that Hoffa saw a lot of hypocrisy in that, how Joe Kennedy, the elder Kennedy, made his money. And I think Hoffa thought, wait a minute, you know, I'm standing up for the little guy and you're this guy, you know, coming from the Ivy League. And there was really a bitter feud between that, almost personal, I mean, very directly personal. And that kind of made Hoffa even more of a champion. And he became president of the Teamsters shortly after that. And then Kennedy went after him. I mean, very, very directly. He went after Hoffa personally, and eventually Hoffa had to go to prison.
Mm-hmm. And what about the general reception, or like what was the opinion of the general public in America about Hoffa in those years? So like, he was a popular hero, right? I mean, or were people actually divided, like between who was cheering for Kennedy, who was cheering for Hoffa? Like, how did this also affect the general like divisions within American society, almost also politically?
Yeah, I mean, Hoffa didn't even finish high school. He's one of these guys that was smart but not professionally or formally educated. So he had an edge to him that I think people thought he's standing up for the little guy and the worker. And in the days of the Eastern establishment, you know, between Boston and Washington, D.C., where you had to be a WASP or go to the right schools to have any kind of public authority, these union guys were new. And a guy like Hoffa, people said, hey, that guy talks like people I know, right? He's not a, you know, he doesn't use perfect English. He's got sort of an image of a fighter. He was a short guy, I think about five feet five, you know, really small guy. But he had this sort of a Jack Russell Terrier type of personality where he was going to fight. And back then, nobody really knew. It's not like now where the media is everywhere. People just read about him, maybe an occasional news story about him. So probably Jimmy Hoffa had a bigger legend at that time as a guy that fights for truck drivers and warehouse guys. You know, that's a very important role at a time when American highways were just being built and they're going away from train travel and freight trains going to trucks. That's a very important industry. And there's a lot of truck drivers that were becoming symbolic of this ordinary guy. The truck driver in American popular culture is really important. It's just usually a simple guy, honest guy, just doing his job. And so those guys liked Hoffa, and Hoffa played that up very well.
Yeah. Right. Well, now that we think of him and of this sort of popularity that he had as a public figure, and we are talking in the year 2020 already, it seems almost like something from a different world, like for a leader of a union, you know, to be that well known, recognizable. I mean, nowadays, you know, unions are not even, you know, they have no leverage whatsoever. I mean, so much happened in between, but it seems like that was the moment when there was this figure for just a regular American working guy to identify with and to trust. I think he had a lot of people had confidence in him.
Yeah, and he was good at PR. You know, he spoke simply, but he spoke effectively. And I think really when he became a notorious figure is when United States citizens started to hear about this thing called the Mafia, or the Cosa Nostra, and this famous hearing in October of 1963, where this guy Valachi spilled the beans and talked all about this whole system of the organized crime, and he talked about everything. And that was the first time I think the average American started to say, I didn't know this existed. And then people started to say, okay, that's who runs the Teamsters, and that's eventually what, you know, created this kind of sympathetic but also romantic image of the Mafia. And you could see this in The Godfather a couple of years later, the novel first and then the film, that really made the Mafia a household word and also kind of sympathetic, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't really ruthless gangsters. They were an organization just like the big three auto companies or something. They had the way that they ran their life, and they, you know, very loyal. The family comes first. Lots of these things in the 1970s, people were losing. Mm-hmm. So in a nostalgic look back in the 50s, this novel and the films had a certain appeal, and the Mafia actually became, I think that's where Scorsese picked it up with Mean Streets and this idea of the mob being sort of a function of the underworld of America that needed to be this simply because they had nowhere else to turn. Mm-hmm. Like the Capone story where poor people liked Al Capone because he gave them food and presents at Christmas. And I think Hoffa had that same sort of appeal until he went to prison. And when he got out of prison, it was a different country, I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, there is always this appeal about gangster films and films about the Mafia, that this moral code that they operate by is very clear cut. Like there are very clear rules to be followed. And if you follow them, you succeed. If you don't follow them, you basically are wiped out. But, and then, you know, in the late 90s, you have Tony Soprano, who is both a mafioso and an Archie Bunker kind of character, you know, like sort of like conservative guy who is out of touch with the current cultural moments, to say the least.
Yeah, and Hoffa was like that too. He was living in the suburbs and had just a normal family with a normal daughter and a normal son, but he was trying to live a double life, right? They probably didn't know what he was doing. But I think Hoffa was symbolic of these changing times. When he went to prison in 1967 and he got out in 1971, there was a lot of changes in American culture just in those 4 or 5 years. And one was Richard Nixon in 1972 was going very directly after this so-called blue-collar vote. It's part of his Southern strategy that all of these workers that used to vote for Democrats like Franklin Roosevelt or Harry Truman, now they were put off by the counterculture, the Vietnam War protest, all of the turmoil of the 60s. And Nixon said, I can get those people to vote Republican for the first time. And Nixon was very sympathetic. Like, he had hard hat guys coming to the White House and visiting him. And I think the pardon of Hoffa in 1971 was part of this. I think there was a very deliberate attempt to say, I'm a Republican, but I support the worker, like Jimmy Hoffa. And Hoffa became a symbol of this. He was released from prison. And Jimmy Hoffa in 1972, when he got out of prison, he thought the world was still the same as when he went in. But it was a very different world, as he would find out. And you can see that in the film.
Mm-hmm. You were a teenager. You were growing up in the 1970s, around the time that Hoffa disappeared. Do you have any recollection of that disappearance and of the whole media havoc that started and basically never really subsided?
Well, I was just a kid, so I don't want to claim that I was really aware of what was going on. By that time, Jimmy Hoffa's disappearance almost became a punchline on Johnny Carson monologue. It was up there with Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, Amelia Earhart, all of these kind of mysteries that sustained the legend. People would always say he's buried underneath the Meadowlands at Giant Stadium, a football stadium, which became kind of an urban legend. But I think what really happened was that Hoffa came out and he wanted to get back to the leadership of the Teamsters. And people said, we have our own guy now, this Frank Fitzsimmons guy who is doing a good job leading the Teamster Union, and he's easier to deal with, and meaning that the mafia was probably getting loans from the Teamsters, interest-free, probably illegal. And Hoffa got out, and he started to be resentful, and he started to, maybe I'm going to talk about all these secrets. And I think that's eventually what got him. This disappearance really probably wasn't that mysterious. If you look at it, probably it was a very efficient job, and they got him very quickly to someplace, got rid of his body, and that was the end of the story. But in films like JFK and all of these films, the mystery and the unknown is more interesting sometimes than what might have actually happened. I have a feeling that it was a very professional job. They knew what they were doing. They took his body somewhere really fast, got rid of it, and nobody talked after that. And that's kind of a boring story, but that's my guess about what happened. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was also an interesting time in American movies in the 70s when there were, and just in terms of the representation of working class people and of this sort of like class struggle, there was interesting films like Norma Rae, for example, with Sally Field as also a union organizer, Blue Collar, the Richard Pryor film, but also an interesting film with Sylvester Stallone called Fist, in which he basically plays Jimmy Hoffa, only he's not named Jimmy Hoffa, he's Johnny Kovac, the Hungarian worker who organizes, people in the factory in the late 30s, but this is basically a Jimmy Hoffa film. Do you recall that film? And Sylvester Stallone, who was fresh off his Rocky success, and also playing those, working class guys, like in Paradise Alley or in those other films.
Yeah, I remember that because everybody knew him. He was an overnight star after Rocky, and that was his next film, I think. It was kind of like John Travolta doing, what was that one he did with Lily Tomlin?
Moment by Moment.
where people said, what is he playing, this guy? Nobody really knew what he was playing, but Fist was a kind of a popular blue-collar movie. That's when union guys were sympathetic, fighting against corruption in Wall Street. They're trying to do their best, fighting an underdog story. Norma Rae, Sally Field was the same. She got an Oscar for that, right? Mm-hmm. And I think there were a lot of films like that in the 70s that probably people don't understand today. Because the 60s and probably even more the 70s, most of the films were about underdogs or turning, the anti-hero, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Bonnie and Clyde and all of those films where what used to be is a bad guy kind of got transformed into a sympathetic character. And you could see that with the union organizers. They were affiliated with the mafia, sure, but they did what they had to do to get by and to help you, the worker, right? And I think the most interesting film on that, if you want to hear a good example of that, in West Virginia, in the mine strikes, you can see this in a film John Sayles made called Matewan. But you could see in Harlan County, in this documentary that came out in the 70s, about this, the leader of the mine union was even more violent sometimes than the Teamsters. And there was two guys, Tony Boyle, who was a leader of the United Mine Workers Union, but he was challenged by a Polish immigre, Jacques Jablonski. And Boyle, after a crooked election, he won the leadership of the mine workers, but Jablonski and his whole family were assassinated in a very violent, assassination attempt. They found out the guy's got $20,000 to do it, just kind of a small sum. But that was the last day of 1969. And I don't know if there's made a film about that, but that's even more interesting than fiction sometimes, what really happened in the mine workers. So it was a really violent time where workers were losing their rights. After the 50s, that was the peak of union membership. And since then, it started to decline to where we are today, where if you ask a kid now who's the leader of a union, they look at you like with dog hair and a funny noise. They don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's quite fascinating, actually, because the documentary you mentioned, Harlan County, USA, made by Barbara Kopple, she got an Oscar for that in 1976. Then, when you look at the 80s, it's basically like the whole subject of, unions almost disappears. There is Matewan, the John Sayles film. There is probably, I would also point to that Meryl Streep film, Silkwood, where she's protesting because she's been exposed to radiation. And, this is also a film born of the same sensibility, let's say. But then after Wall Street and after this birth of a new American hero who was, Charlie Sheen on one side and probably Melanie Griffith in Working Girl on the other, you basically don't see stories like that.
Yeah, and those are kind of silly films. I mean, Working Girl, I mean, there's obviously some social importance to it, but it's not that grit that you saw in Harlan County, which was a documentary. We should mention that. It's not a motion picture. And in Matewan, where guys, James Earl Jones, the mine workers would get Italians and black workers and mix them together to try to do this divide and rule. But they eventually got together and they realized that they had more important things in common than their color of their skin. They were workers. And Sayles does a pretty good job of that. That was in the 80s, I think, that film was made. And I think one of the things that replaced the worker movie was the mafia films. You could see this in Mean Street. Those guys were kind of working stiffs. They weren't the top mafia guys like The Godfather. They were just guys doing their job on the streets. And I think that kind of replaced this underdog story of the worker, but keeping that grit and kind of the gritty glamour of De Niro and Harvey Keitel in the streets trying to just make their name for themselves in the early 70s. Yeah.
Before we briefly discuss The Irishman specifically, I also want to ask you about one specific moment in film history when JFK opened in 1991, because I think that film really opened a whole new kind of worms and also like in many ways influenced all the other films that were tackling politics and were engaging in conspiracy theories later on. Do you recall that moment when that film opened?
Yeah, that was Oliver Stone, and that movie was in, I think it's, I'm guessing, late 91 it came out, and that tied up a lot of things from the 60s, from especially the organized crime links to that, which involved Hoffa, by the way. Hoffa is one of those guys, he's connected to everything. The Monroe, Marilyn Monroe, Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy, the Mafia, Cuba, Castro. And Oliver Stone tried to tie all that together, and it disturbed some people because he made some very direct accusations in that film and used some composite characters. The Donald Sutherland character, I forget, it was Mr. X or something. But it later turned out, and there's some people that are Hoffa scholars that say that there was some credibility to that the mafia, especially the New Orleans mafia, the Florida mafia, together maybe with the Chicago Mafia, had this blood feud against the Kennedys, Bobby Kennedy, and they say, we can't kill Bobby Kennedy because that's too obvious, so we'll just kill his brother and we'll get rid of him at the same time. That was the idea, how the mob and Castro and the anti-Castro emigre community came together and took out the president. And it was a controversial movie. I think if you made it now, it would be even more so. I think in 91, it was before social media, and the movie came and went, and then it went on to video, and people kind of got on with their lives. But it was a pretty bold statement that Oliver Stone made in that film.
I just imagined what would have happened today, you know, if a movie like that opened on social media. It would be like the apocalypse. I think like people would kill each other on social media after that. But that film also ties into The Irishman, in that The Irishman presents itself sort of as the objective story. You know, it follows the testimony of Frank Sheeran, who, you know, told it to Charles Brandt, the reporter. Of course, there are many articles online that also, you know, debunk sort of what Sheeran says. But I want to ask you about one specific scene when Hoffa, played by Al Pacino, learns of Kennedy's assassination. He's in Miami. He's in this sort of diner. He's indulging his taste for ice cream again, which is like straight in this film. And he sort of just looks very, very like calmly at the TV set, and then he comes back and he eats his ice cream. I read online that actually Hoffa cheered when he learned of Kennedy's assassination in that Miami place. Can you comment on the scene and also on the Hoffa in the film?
You know, if it's Al Pacino playing Jimmy Hoffa, which is two legends, you know, actually when I was watching the film, I didn't know if I was watching Al Pacino play Jimmy Hoffa, or I am of the personal opinion, I like to see unknown actors play these big famous people, because it's hard for me to distinguish between who's Al Pacino and who's Jimmy Hoffa. But I think probably if you read anything about Jimmy Hoffa, he really hated the Kennedys. I mean, it was the film with Robert Blake was actually called Blood Feud. It was a made for TV film when I think in the early 80s or something, and I think that Hoffa really, really resented the Kennedys. He hated their privileged background. He hated how they were going after him when he knew they were doing things that weren't, if the public knew what the Kennedys really were like, especially John, in his extramarital affairs and so forth, that he thought they were sort of hypocrites. So, and you know, Hoffa was a guy from the streets. He was a blue collar guy from Detroit, and he probably resented the Ivy League people. He probably dealt with them a lot, and I think that's very plausible that he cheered when Kennedy was shot. I can't prove it. I don't have any evidence of that, but I know he really, really disliked the Kennedys, and he really resented the system that was going after him. Because I think Hoffa was directly involved with the mob. But I think if you were sympathetic to Hoffa, which a lot of people are, probably unreasonably so. I think a lot of people shine Hoffa up a little bit and make him into a hero when he was really kind of a mixed gray character. Mm. But Hoffa would say, listen, I got those Teamster pensions the size they were. The mob got kicked out of Cuba. So I loaned that money out of the pension funds, and the mafia made Las Vegas. So everybody wins, right? And Las Vegas now looks like Disneyland. And Hoffa would say, yeah, they couldn't have done it without me loaning them money out of these pension funds. And I think Hoffa says, you know, you can't play by the rules in the United States and get away with it. You gotta fight the system. And if the rules are against you, you gotta break them. And I think that's the appeal of Hoffa and the mafia and the unions in American folklore, is that they were kind of renegades. They were romantic heroes fighting the system. Because in America in the 1950s, if you weren't Protestant and you weren't white, it was really hard to make a living without being in a union. And a lot of my friends growing up, where I grew up, one of my best friends, his dad was a truck driver, literally. I'd see his rig in front of his house. My friend in college, his dad was a Teamster. And so I was familiar with this world. I mean, it was a lot of my friends were just kind of regular, you know, workers, and a lot of them were truck drivers. And I think they kind of felt like Hoffa had their back, or guys like Hoffa. And now I couldn't tell you who the leader of the Teamsters is. I had no idea right now, sitting in this interview, who the leader of the Teamsters was, because it's just a different world. Labor is completely different. It's got obliterated in the 1980s. And then things like NAFTA in the 1990s meant that unions had even less power and, you know, that in the pop culture, they don't even exist. Try making a movie in 2020 about a union. You'd get nowhere. I mean, nobody would watch it because there's no dashing Robin Hood character anymore.
Yeah, it's a completely different world. Well, 1 year after Oliver Stone made his JFK, Danny DeVito, of all people, made a film on Hoffa with the unlikely casting of Jack Nicholson, who was never a like working man's hero, unless you count maybe, I don't know, Five Easy Pieces. But it was a film that really didn't do very well. I mean, it was nominated for some Oscars, but it didn't get anything. Do you recall that film at all when it opened at that time? That portrayal of Hoffa is kind of interesting. I think the film fails in like as a film, but it's interesting in some aspects.
Yeah, I remember that film in some ways, and I think Hoffa has. Sometimes the documentaries are more interesting than the feature films because that film came out, Jack Nicholson playing Hoffa. Five Easy Pieces, by the way, is one of my favorite films of all time because he plays a really complicated guy caught between the class warfare of the 60s and 70s. He's a classical pianist and he's, you know, working in the oil fields, kind of where I grew up, actually, where that film starts. But I think Hoffa in 1992, it was kind of like JFK. I think they came out around the same time, I'm guessing within a year of each other. And again, it was the same. I mean, Nicholson played a pretty good Hoffa. I thought he actually looked like him. But in that film, they're playing in a lot of, you know, suppositions. Like, you know, I think Danny DeVito is actually with him at the Red Fox, you know, and so he's waiting for somebody. And they make a lot of assumptions about what happened. I think the car got put into a truck and disappeared or something. But, you know, it's hard to make a movie, a feature movie about somebody who's in real life because people could see that's not Jimmy Hoffa, that's Jack Nicholson. I think one of the great things about the age we're living in now is documentaries are more interesting than feature motion pictures because they can see what really happened. They're more historically accurate. I think people kind of resent that they make adaptations to make the script more sympathetic, kind of like Hoffa not cheering at the Kennedy assassination when you read that he did. You know, people say, well, what else aren't you telling us? You know, like, are you shining up these characters to make them more sympathetic just because of the film? And in documentaries, you don't have to do that. And I think that's why they're more effective. Kind of like Harlan County, USA, the film that you mentioned earlier. That's a really unvarnished look at the mine workers in the 1970s. I mean, there's no Sally Field there. You know, playing Norma Ray. Those people don't have teeth. They're living in tar shacks up in the Appalachian Mountains, trying to get by every day. And it's a pretty good look. I recommend that film. I think it's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube and it's really fantastic. And I think it also comes from this different era when, you know, a documentary filmmaker like Barbara Kopple would just go there and, you know, film all those people with no judgment. You know, there is no judgment being passed on those people. It's just showing this very raw reality of their struggle. Whereas later on, I think there were those layers and layers of irony, you know, like within culture, that it's very easy to make jokes of those people. But when you see that film, you are not in the mood for making any jokes, you know.
I lived in West Virginia for 10 years and they were some of the best people I ever met, really. And so one of my really pet peeves is hearing jokes about working poor people in West Virginia or Kentucky, because it's not easy to live. Even in the 60s and 70s, it was really hard. And when that coal ran out, those companies ran out. And those people were left with almost 60% unemployment. And when the coal miners leave and the coal companies leave, so do the bartenders, the hairstylists, the doctors. It just killed these towns. And so when people make fun of places like Kentucky and West Virginia in, you know, living in their comfort of a, you know, hipster gentrified neighborhood, it really bugs me. Because if you watch Harlan County, those people are just living day by day and they don't know if they got something to eat in the morning, never mind retirement and these kind of things that we associate, you know, modern life with. I mean, they were really struggling. And I think Hoffa ties into that a little bit. And if we want to get back to The Irishman, he's kind of a complicated guy. He goes to war. He learns how to kill. And it's almost like that old adage, if your dog gets into a chicken coop and kills your chickens, he's going to like the chicken, so you got to get rid of that dog somehow because he's going to do it again. But he comes back to post-war America, and he becomes a hitman because killing was easy. He did it in World War II. It was his job. And he becomes kind of this sympathetic, kind of Leon the Professional kind of guy that reluctantly becomes a hitman, just doing his job. And then at the end, he has kind of a Sophie's Choice there with having to kill his hero, and that makes good drama. I don't know if it's true or not. That's been debated, but it's a good story.
Well, and it definitely ties into the long-lived obsession of Scorsese of this, you know, male friendship and, you know, the betrayal and, you know, all of this that we already saw in his films in different versions. So, well, thank you so much for this, and it was great to talk to you again, and hopefully see you again on another episode.
It's a pleasure, Michal. You do a great job with these. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Raz jeszcze dziękuję profesorowi Patrykowi Wanowi z Instytutu Amerykanistyki i Studiów Polonijnych Uniwersytetu Jagiellońskiego. Wspaniale, że udało się znowu z nim porozmawiać, a ja zapraszam Was już za tydzień do kolejnego Spoilermastera. Zachęcam do tego, żeby dzielić się linkiem do podcastu, a także dla tych, którzy są zainteresowani, jeżeli chcielibyście otrzymać naklejkę Spoilermastera, zapraszam, wystarczy napisać na mój adres mailowy michal.oleszczyk@gmail.com i wysłać swój adres domowy. Ja wyślę naklejkę z niewielką prośbą, aby naklejkę po naklejeniu sfotografować, wrzucić do swoich mediów społecznościowych z linkiem do fanpage'a mojego podcastu. Bardzo Wam dziękuję, witam raz jeszcze w roku 2020, a także polecam, żeby zajrzeć na mojego bloga Ostatni Fotel po prawej stronie, gdzie opublikowałem pełne podsumowanie roku 2019, podzieliłem wszystkie filmy, które obejrzałem na kategorie i to zestawienie można obserwować na stronie. Także Ostatni Fotel po prawej stronie, zapraszam i do usłyszenia w następnym odcinku.